The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, The Hand of God. On Saturday, we watched England versus Argentina from Mexico 86 together on a Google Hangout, and we'll look back at it today. Did England deserve anything from the game? Did Bobby Robson get his tactics right? Why did Gary Lineker get involved in our Twitter thread? And was it a handball? Yes, it was. Also, we'll update you on the latest effects of COVID-19. Maldini and Fellaini testing positive while Russia suspend their Premier League. There's footballers doing good in Corona Positivity Corner. Football carries on in Australia and elsewhere. There's all that, your questions, and Chapter 1 of Detective Wilson. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, opposite me, but I'd say 4 metres away, Barry Glendenning. Barry, nice to see you.
Hello, Max.
Now, interestingly, the setup is thus, I have moved from my chair, but Barry stays in his chair.
Yes, producer Jonathan asked me to sit elsewhere, and I pointedly refused, so you've had to move. Barry's chair is Barry's chair. And it's not so much a chair, it's a state of mind and a space at the desk.
Now, that laugh you can hear in the background is one half of Stadio Podcast, which is great, by the way, if you don't listen to it. And that is Musa Okwonga. Musa, how are you?
Very well, thanks. I'm just laughing at the fact that Barry's actually a cat.
I should have worked that out for so long. He sleeps for 16 hours a day. Although, to be fair, cats wash their own hair, and Barry doesn't do that. The technically savvy part of Stadio is Ryan Hun. He knows how to press the buttons. That's what we've established in the hour it's taken us to all get this to a record level. Ryan, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks, Max. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thanks very much. So,
long time no speak.
Isn't it? We all Google hung out on Saturday night. Lots of people are having that kind of adventure, aren't they? And talking to people over the internet. So we'll talk about what we did on Saturday night. But Musa, how is it over in Berlin right now?
It's really quiet. They've just had a ban on gatherings over two people. So that's a sort of compromise between locking everything down and not. And so, like, the streets now are kind of funereal. It's really peaceful. But as a freelance writer, it's basically just a normal day for me, to be honest.
You are well prepared for self-isolation, are you, Musa?
Yeah, I am, actually. I mean, I've been doing it for the last 20 years, so it's kind of nothing new here, unfortunately.
Ryan, you?
Yeah, it's all right. It's fine. Got a lot to do. I have to talk to this guy every other day to do a podcast at the moment.
Oh my God.
And then by the time I finished editing it, there's not really much time to do anything else anyway. So
how much, Ryan, do you miss football?
I'm starting to miss it a little bit now. The first weekend without it, I was actually quite pleased in a way. It felt like quite good to get a bit of a break. I think that I hadn't realised just how much football there is constantly. And especially with the, you know, international tournaments in the summer now, and then you have these kind of pre-season tours and tournaments. It actually felt quite nice to have a weekend away from football.
I'd kind of be of the same opinion. I'm looking at social media and there's guys on there claiming to be bereft without it. I think they might be just exaggerating for effect. I haven't missed it much at all. I will at some point go, ooh, I'd quite like to see a game of football, but, you know, there are other things to do.
But I think it's what it represents, I guess, isn't it, Musa? I mean, I feel like I've just taken it for granted for so long and that I just presumed it was always going to be there and now it isn't there. It is just such a part of the routine, actually playing as much as watching for me.
I don't know, because I feel like it's more like The Sopranos, where you love watching it in real time with everyone else, but then you go back and watch individual scenes over the years. And I find myself dipping back into Sopranos, like, I'll go and watch specific scenes that I love watching. And I feel it's the same with football. It's like, there's just always, you know, YouTube is basically like our kind of Netflix now, right? When it comes to football highlights. So there's just always something to watch. And I find myself actually watching, if anything, even more of that stuff now than I did before. So I guess maybe I'm a bit of an outlier like that, but I don't miss the live stuff at all, to be honest. Sorry, that's not the right thing to say, but that's how I feel.
I mean, we will field accusations on the back of this, but people saying, oh, you don't even like football. That's not the case. It really isn't. I do like football. I love it. But there wasn't much jeopardy left in this season for me. And you know, Liverpool were going to win the league. I don't really care who gets relegated. Ditto for the Championship. My only interest, will Sunderland get promoted from League One? And they almost certainly wouldn't have, because they're Sunderland.
I have a confession, which is, Musa, I stopped at Series 3 of The Sopranos.
Oh my God, you're a monster.
I mean, I've got time, I guess.
That's like stopping at, so the group stage is the Champions League. That's shocking.
It's basically what's happened, though, right?
Yeah, well, it is. Yes. Monstrous.
Actually, Max, just to jump in quick, I think that from my point of view personally, I mean, I'd caveat that with saying, you know, 2 weekends without football is quite nice, but it is getting to the point where you would like to watch some stuff. And personally, the Bundesliga was really exciting this season. Had the first real title race in a long, long time. And, you know, you had 3 or 4 teams who could potentially win the title. And even though Bayern are top, it's a bit of a shame to see that momentum halted, because that was really gearing up for a really exciting final stretch.
I thought that Atleti, I've got to say, this was the year I thought Atleti could have done it as well in the Champions League, because the one thing they were lacking was that firepower. If you think of the other rounds they went out in before, and this was the first time they really pulled it together and had the full package, and then it's kind of gone. And that is, I do find that really sad, to be honest. And I hope they find a way to maybe finish that tournament if possible.
So what did you do this weekend instead, Ryan?
Hung out with you lot on Saturday night. Yes. Watching an old football match, which is very cool. And got a little bit drunk. I didn't realise until afterwards. And then we did Stadio on Sunday because we were doing this with you guys today. So
the subject of this Stadio podcast is quite a cool one.
Yeah, so we, based off a question from a listener, a regular listener, shout out to Kunle Ajayo, who I think is a big, big fan of Football Weekly as well. He sent in a question asking about if we were to make an all-time 20-team league, taking any teams throughout history, who would they be? So we've probably missed a few because we did it on the fly. We didn't sit down and plan anything. We just kind of did it live. But yeah, 20 teams containing teams throughout all of history. Only club teams, though, and men's teams.
And did you only pick good ones, or did you say we need to have, you know, Everton from 2003, whatever happened there, and, you know, and Sunderland from that season?
There were a few curveballs, weren't there, Musa?
Yeah, that's right. We put in, like, Juan de Ramos's Sevilla.
Hey, no spoilers, man.
Oh, is that the thing? No content. We've got to give them something.
We need to use this to drive people to our podcast. That's what, you know, that's the whole point, right?
But we agreed beforehand, Ryan. We've got to throw them a bone. This is one of the two bones.
This is the trailer.
Yeah, exactly.
I know of one team that was not included that would drive a lot of people to your podcast if we were to say who they were, but I'm saying nothing. I'm keeping stum.
And the deal here is we drive listeners to your podcast, we take your ideas and do them in a few weeks.
That's a fair exchange.
Right. The updates from the coronavirus within football. Former Real Madrid president Lorenzo Sanz has died at the age of 76 due to COVID-19. He was the president from 1995 to 2000, during which time Real won their first European Cup since the 60s, ending that 32-year wait. He signed players such as Davor Suker, Roberto Carlos, Clarence Seedorf, as well as Steve McManaman and Nicolas Anelka. Charlie Austin has urged people don't take it lightly after suffering with acute symptoms. Austin wasn't tested, but was told by his doctor that his symptoms matched those of COVID-19. He believes he contracted it at the Cheltenham Festival, the racing festival. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, which went ahead to much surprise from a lot of people. Paolo Maldini and his son have tested positive. Paolo Dybala has tested positive as well, as have 4 Portsmouth players. Marouane Fellaini is in isolation in China at Jinan Hospital. An Irish footballer called Lee Duffy tweeted over the weekend to say that he was hooked up to a ventilator for 8 days before recovering. He said, "My advice to everybody is to not take this lightly. It is very serious." Arsenal have put training on hold indefinitely. Russia have now suspended play in their Premier League. So have Turkey's Super League. Elsewhere, away from COVID-19, really sad news about Peter Whittingham. Died at the age of 35. Cardiff City legend was watching the England-Wales rugby match 2 weeks ago in a local pub at his home in Penarth. He fell, suffered head injuries, which he didn't recover from. He played 457 games for Cardiff, scoring 96 goals. Had a wonderful left foot. Also playing games for Aston Villa, Burnley, Derby County and Blackburn across his career. Football is carrying on. And I don't know how you feel about this it's obviously hard to know when you're not in that particular country. But in Australia, the biggest league in the world that is still in operation is the A-League. The FFA apparently terrified of the financial implications of suspending or cancelling the season. Today's match between Perth Glory and Western United was called off 12 hours before kickoff, with Western United reluctant to fly in case of stricter guidelines on travel were implemented while they were in Perth. Newcastle Jets played Melbourne City earlier, with Newcastle winning 2-1. The winning goal, a 30-yard strike from Stephen Ugarkovic. Seems so strange to talk about the quality of a goal at this time. And a really weird moment. Newcastle brought on veteran keeper Glenn Moss for the last 10 minutes. He's announced his retirement at the end of the season, with no way of knowing whether this will be the last game played this season. He had a kind of muted reception, no fans in the crowd. You know, the Australians worried about the financial implications and trying to weigh that up with health and well-being of people.
I just think it's a really fair burden to put on clubs and players. Like, you know, it's the same thing with, like, you know, walking off a pitch when there's abuse. You shouldn't, those decisions shouldn't be in the hands of people whose job it is to get out there and entertain. They should just have indemnified them against all future losses and just covered the costs and said, look, your health and your safety is worth too much. The government will foot the bill or find a way to foot it at some point in the future. That's my view anyway.
A question from Martin saying the Burundi Premier League is still playing. We have a sweepstake going. I would welcome the panel's views on the relative chances of Le Massage Ngozi and their opponents Vital O. There's £40 on this. Hashtag we shall have football. Barry?
I obviously haven't a clue. I've never heard of either of those teams. And without wanting to be a buzzkill, that kind of seems one of those, because it's far away in a place we don't know much about, it's funny. Is it serious over there? I literally don't know. But
this is interesting. So Burundi, they've closed all flights for 7 days, but they've got no reported cases as yet. So they've closed flights. So actually, there seems to be a kind of oasis of COVID-19-free sporting activity so far. So fingers crossed for them.
Well, let's all jump on the Burundi bandwagon then.
I mean, we wouldn't go that far. We technically can't because they've suspended all flights. But let's spiritually, we are there. We are in Bujumbura. Spiritually, we're there.
Barry, you could find another way of getting there, I presume.
Yeah.
Well, no, I just meant something to keep an eye on. I wasn't going to go and live there.
send Barry to Burundi.
That sounds quite good.
Hey, we could pitch that show to Dave. I'm sure they would take it. Right, lads, that'll do for part one. Part two is entirely about the football match we watched at the weekend. I don't want to give spoilers, but I will. Argentina knocking England out of the 1986 World Cup 2-1. Maradona with quite a big part to play in both goals. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Right, let's go back to England-Argentina, 1986. We watched it together on a Google Hangout, and I think it was, Barry, I thought it was just a really fun thing to do for an evening.
I did enjoy it. I'd recommend it. And I followed up afterwards with a similar thing with my Irish friends, having a few cans, some in Australia, some in Ireland, me here, and that was really good fun. So something to do if you're bored and to lift your spirits. I think you did one last week as well. But the game itself, there was a lot about it I'd forgotten. To be honest, I was 13 when that was played, and I don't know if I saw the whole thing at the time, but I was surprised by the poor quality of the pitch. I was surprised by the poor quality of the game. I was surprised by the poor quality of England, because to hear the players involved continue to whinge about the injustice visited upon them, while there was one obvious injustice, they did not deserve to win that game in any way.
What were your big takeaways, Ryan, from this?
The pitch really needed watering. That was the one thing, the first thing. Because you just saw how many players were having trouble controlling the ball that was passed to them on the floor. It was bubbling up really, really quite badly. And, you know, when you have such technically gifted players like Glenn Hoddle playing in the centre of midfield, you know, you'd like a nice slick surface so he can, you know, whiz it into Peter Reid's feet. Yeah, Peter Reid's hair colour blew me away. That's the... a nice bluey grey of an era that you'd have kind of, you don't really see that much anymore in a footballer playing in a World Cup. But also, We were talking about this. Actually, it surprised me how the kind of combinations, yes, the pace was maybe a little bit different, but obviously you're playing it in, you know, midday sun in the middle of summer. I was surprised actually how many similarities there were with recent World Cup games played in a similar time. The pace was quite slow. And the passing combinations, I mean, I might have to go back and rewatch it to be 100% sure, but the actual passing combinations that England played and Argentina played to some extent weren't a million miles away from the kind of combinations you see in today's game. Obviously, just maybe in today's game, they would be a little bit quicker and it would kind of, the ball would continuously move, whereas the ball is given away quite cheaply a lot. But yeah, I was actually, it wasn't a huge amount different. And also one final thing was actually I was surprised how little the keepers exploited the back pass rule, or the pre-back pass rule, or lack of.
Yeah, that blew my mind as well. I was really surprised, you know, Argentina 2-0 didn't just kick it back to the keeper all the time. That was some sort of ethical way that people played the game. And you go back to that 1989 game where, you know, Liverpool, why don't they just keep kicking it back to Grobbelaar? Like, then they'd win the league in 89. Moussa, I mean, it took you sort of down a philosophical path of the myth of the World Cup, didn't it?
Well, yeah, because I was thinking, are we really judging this? Is this really the decisive arbiter of greatness when, you know, this game has been revered as a classic match? Marker just put out an article saying it's on the top 50 classic matches of all time, World Cup games. And I was like, but it's not a classic game. And if you think of all the luck that goes into the right squad of players being fit, you know, every 4 years, so that the great player can come in and like elevate a group of really good players to something greater, like Baggio, for example, in 94, who gets mocked for that missed penalty, but dragged that team to the final. It makes you kind of, what made me reassess Messi's legacy, Baggio's legacy, and be like, look, what Maradona did was great. But it also makes you think maybe we're a bit harsh on people that take their teams to the final, but not that final step further. But one thing I also want to throw in, and this is a bit random, it's not quite philosophical, it's more tactical. Looking at Steve Hodges' performance, he didn't have the best game. And I thought, why was he there? Like, and then I looked at his previous performances and I thought, well, actually, it's because he had a great tournament till that point. And one thing with Bobby Robson, which some might say was a flaw, but I think it was actually a great strength overall, was his loyalty in players. And I think Bobby Robson really understood the flow of a tournament and getting his team to build momentum throughout a tournament. And I think this is a strange example, actually, of where it didn't work for Bobby Robson, where he had faith in players throughout the tournament, but when he needed it most, they didn't deliver. And the funny thing is that Steve Hodge in the previous games actually runs with the ball a bit more, and he barely does that against Argentina. And you could argue, actually, on a pitch with a surface that bad, a running game rather than a passing game was the best way to go.
And actually, that's an interesting point, because we were talking about Gary Lineker and Peter Beardsley, and that had obviously been really, really good. They'd been really good together in this World Cup and developed a really good understanding. But when you looked at how England played, with that midfield not being able to keep the ball, they needed someone to hold the ball up. And Robson didn't have Mark Hatley on the bench, because you didn't have your whole squad on the bench in those World Cups. You picked five substitutes, and he didn't include Hatley or Kerry Dixon, but Hatley would have been the guy that probably would have helped that situation.
Right, I think so. I mean, Ryan, what do you think of that? Because you had some views about the passing as well.
Yeah, well, we were saying that because we thought that Ray Wilkins was suspended, but he was available for the game and on the bench. And we were actually saying that maybe England just looked a little bit, not light, but maybe lacking a little of extra something in midfield next to Glenn Hoddle. I mean, maybe Ray Wilkins, for me, was probably a little bit of a surprise that he didn't play. And like we mentioned before, obviously I know John Barnes was young at the time, but John Barnes either not starting the game or coming on that late was a big surprise, because the impact he had straight away was immense.
Johnny writes, I've never watched this game. It was before I was born, but I can't believe how, in his words, butthurt English fans have been all these years. England were dire. Midfield looked like they were playing in treacle. He also says the back pass rule has saved football. And I'm loath to criticise Glenn Hoddle, Barry, but he didn't have a great game, did he?
No, I can't remember which of us it was, so I'm going to pretend it was me that said it would be really interesting if Opta were around in those days, what would his pass completion rate, because that was a guy who could pass a football. I mean, he's one of the best players I've ever seen, but he did not have a good day at the office there. Perhaps the pitch contributed to that factor, but I presume he was used to playing on bad pitches.
Hoddle's pass selection was quite strange as well in that game. Like, he hits a lot of high balls into crowded spaces. He doesn't take the easy options. I just think it was one of those ones where it's a bit of a cliche, but you know those times when there are players that have a collective malfunction and they go out and they've given particular instructions and they just, nothing really works. The more I think about that game and the performance that I saw, I was like, well, tactically they were conservative. There's a lot of individual errors as well. Apart from Kenny Sansom, who really, I think, was outstanding. Everyone else was maybe like 20%, 30% below par.
Yeah. Was Terry Fenwick really the second best centre-back in England? I mean, he got booked early and he probably could have been sent off three times in that game. I mean, I know he was probably given some instructions to stop Maradona. We'll get onto Maradona in just a second. But I was racking my brains. There must have been centre-backs who were better than Fenwick. I feel bad saying it just in case he's a loyal listener to the Football Weekly.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And another question I had, which was more about how we watch football, but certainly three of us watch that from a very one-sided perspective, I guess. I don't know about you, Barry, from an England perspective, but apart from Maradona, did anyone impress you for Argentina? Barry?
Well, the players I remember from that World Cup, the Argentinians, are Burruchaga, Jorge Valdano, who would later become famous for his shit on the stick remarks. I thought it was a decent collective effort, but they were up against very little. And the thing to remember, I suppose, is those Argentinian players, almost all of them were playing in Argentina at the time. Right now, they'd be scattered over across various European leagues. So they knew each other very well. And in Carlos Bilardo, who's famous for his micromanaging, a bit like Pep Guardiola, they were very, very well drilled. They were even drilled insofar as he specified how they were allowed to celebrate goals.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And how were they allowed to celebrate them?
I don't know, the nitty gritty.
Have to consult the lawyers before you're allowed to tell everyone.
Watch the way they celebrated goals, I suppose.
Maradona was allowed to run off, even if he'd punched it into the net. Now, we must say, I had a bit of a meltdown before on Saturday because the official FIFA version had Jim Proudfoot commentating on it. Now, he was 14 when the game happened, so clearly they've added that commentary in post. And I was desperate for us to watch the grainy Barry Davis version. It turned out, because we're on Google Hangout, it didn't matter. But bless Jim Proudfoot, because when the handball happens, he as a commentator is trying to sound surprised and pretending that he wasn't sure if there was a handball or not, where clearly his whole life he's known that there was a handball there. The story of the handball is fascinating, isn't it? The referee afterwards, there's a big sort of set to between the ref and the linesman. Al Bin Nasser is the referee saying, "I was waiting for Dochev," that's the linesman, "to give me a hint of what exactly happened, but he didn't signal for a handball. The instructions FIFA gave us before the game were clear. If a colleague was in a better position than mine, I should respect his view. Bogdan Dochev, the assistant, said, although I felt immediately there was something irregular, back in that time, FIFA didn't allow the assistants to discuss the decisions with the referee," which is absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? He also said, "If FIFA had put a referee from Europe in charge of such an important game, the first goal of Maradona would have been disallowed." And Dochev really suffered after the game, saying years later, "Diego Maradona ruined my life. He's a brilliant footballer, but a small man. He is low in height and as a person." The other person who gets criticised, well, Steve Hodge gets criticised for his part in the handball, and Peter Shilton as well, in that he still should have got there and timed his jump. What do we think, Musa?
I think there's a lot of revisionism going in around that game. I'm sorry, I'm going to sound really harsh, but I think there was always an extra goal in Argentina. It's really interesting because I've been reading some of the old match reports, and almost none of them mention the fact that Argentina hit the inside of the post at 2-1. Like, no one talks about that. We always hear this. It was like a massive onslaught and England were like, they had them on the ropes the entire like last 15 minutes. They didn't actually. Like, so this whole thing about, you know, the decision being poor, don't get me wrong, was a terrible decision. And Maradona didn't help by celebrating with the same hand that he scored with, which was very sort of conspicuous. But there was time to pull those goals back. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not the first time in a big match a team has gone unjustly behind, you know, an injustice, an unfair goal. But there was plenty of time to pull that back, and England had enough quality to get the job done. Like, I'm going to sound really harsh here, but this, like, Jonathan, this is the first time I'd watched the game. I wasn't allowed to watch it as a kid because I was a bit too young. But I'm watching it back and going, wow, we're like really aggrieved about this. Okay, come on, guys. Sorry, that's harsh to your listeners.
No, that's how I feel. At what age were you allowed to watch football?
This was just too early. So I was seven. I'd just gone seven. And my mum was like, sorry, it's just past your bedtime. Because I'm not sure what the time difference was, but it meant that I couldn't. I basically was all upstairs. I mean, like, you know, conservative immigrant family, it's like upstairs to bed, like at 6 p.m.
Right.
Like, stay in your room and then, yeah.
I'm sure that will resonate with a lot of listeners of around a similar age. The second goal, though, voted the world goal of a century in a poll on the FIFA website. Michael Owens against Argentina was second, which is, I wonder who was voting. Michael says, was Peter Reid dragging an invisible caravan for Maradona's second goal? And there was another question about, and I didn't spot this when we were watching it. Apparently Hoddle gets fouled before Maradona picks up the ball. I mean, some more, you know, hope. They arguably had time after that foul to stop Maradona. It is such an amazing goal, Ryan, isn't it?
Yeah, I think watching it in the context of the game as a whole makes it even more impressive, because we've all seen that goal a million times on various clips or TV shows or documentaries or whatever. But I know this might annoy a lot of listeners, but for me personally, Lionel Messi is the greatest player of all time. And there's moments in games, for example, where you see him almost kind of like sizing the opposition up for maybe 15, 20 minutes and then explodes into one of his trademark finishes where he will go from the halfway line. And this was probably the closest thing I'd seen from Maradona that matches that kind of argument of him being up there with Messi, because of the context of the game. Having just done what he did beforehand, with literally beforehand, and then following it up with a goal like that, I think it's because this is the first time I've watched the game in its entirety. And yeah, that goal for me, I think coming in the context of the game, is just even more impressive.
Ryan, I would agree that Messi is the greatest of all time, but I think that has to come with an asterisk, the asterisk denoting that he hasn't suffered the same kind of brutality as Maradona did, and he plays on pitches that are hell of a lot better than Maradona.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, but I also think that Messi has suffered a fair amount of brutality. I mean, I think there is actually a YouTube compilation that you can watch where basically it's just people scything him down. Now, obviously, it's a different era and people don't get scythed down as badly as they did back 30 years ago. But I think also it's hard to compare eras, isn't it? Because obviously the circumstances are different. But I think that I totally take that point. I do think actually of any modern player, I think probably people go after Messi more than they would go after anyone, in my opinion, anyway. But
I definitely want to see the relative scything from the 80s onwards. Jose gets in touch to say, what struck me is how tough Maradona was. The dude got kicked all match and just kept going. More generally, if a tackle didn't interfere with play, the ref was just content to let it go as well. There are a few vicious shots away from the ball the ref saw and ignored. And Darren says, what did you all think of the Diego Maradona documentary? Channel 4 in the UK put that on Saturday night, so lots of people watched it. And it's the same point. What struck me from that documentary on the pitch for Maradona, because so much of it is about the pressure he was under at Napoli and how he just couldn't cope with that, and I think understandably so given how sort of crazy and manic his life was off the pitch, but on the pitch just getting booted and booted and booted and just getting up. We should talk about the introduction of John Barnes. It is a fascinating moment in the game. Mike says, why didn't Barnes start? England only looked like scoring once he came on. And he does make such an impact, Musa, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And I, like Ryan was saying yesterday, actually, I'd be interested to go back and see if Bobby Robson had second guessed himself, but I couldn't find anything immediately about him saying that he really regretted the tactical choices. I think that was always the idea, to bring Barnes in against tiring legs and just cut them open. And there's an argument that he might not have done. If you look at the first half, for example, Argentina were really playing on the front foot and running really aggressively at the heart of the centre-backs. So maybe Robson was, you know, obviously was playing the long game. But what was quite strange was reading subsequent interviews with Robson, I think around 1919, he was saying how he absolutely loved wingers. Like he had so much faith in Waddle and Barnes. And you think, where was that Robson on the day? And this is not to sort of criticise too much. It's more like he sounded so proud of England's attacking capability. And I just wonder if he overestimated Argentina a little bit going into that game and slightly regrets having done so. I don't know.
On the second Lineker chance that it's so painful because Barnes has done it again and put this beautiful ball over. And I was live tweeting the game and I said, you know, Lineker's got a great chance and it's a great defensive header. And Barney Ronay said, why didn't Lineker just slyly palm the ball into the net? He wasn't going to reach it. What's he got to lose at this stage? And then Gary Lineker responded going, but he did reach it. And then Gary Lineker said to us, I could have, but I watched it all the way to my head. I was shocked.
Yeah, it was a brilliant defensive header because the defender gets his head in just underneath the ball ahead of Lineker and heads away with the back of his head. Like it's a brilliant clearance. And it's funny because that's another moment that's quite interesting because everyone talks about like, why didn't he just get there? Like the cross was perfectly set up. And it's like, well, anyone that watched Lineker for all those years, I mean, that's literally what he did. He always got there. But the defender anticipated, which I think is just absolutely brilliant.
In real time, I couldn't figure out what had happened. And then when they showed the replay, one of the three replays of the whole game, it seemed, it was just amazing. I couldn't actually believe that he'd cleared it in the way that he had done.
Bob says, it's taken 30 odd years of chewing on glass, but I now have to admit Maradona was a magician and Argentina deserved to win. Clubber says, would you give back Jeff Hurst's goal that never was if Maradona's hand of God was chalked off? Well, that's a tough existential question because I wasn't alive in 66. I'd rather see it selfishly in my lifetime, but I don't know if that's too big a risk because England still have to win that game and then still have to beat Belgium and then still have to beat West Germany, and semi-finals aren't our best, are they?
I'd chalk off Jeff Hurst's goal to beat Germany in 1990 because I think England win that tournament.
Yeah, that's a good shout to win that penalty. Oh, would you trade that goal for one of those penalties, Pierce's penalty to go in, and then you're in the unknown?
Yeah, I think I'd rather Waddle's to go in if I'm going to pick. Okay, I don't know why.
I'd rather
see Waddle bag it in the top corner.
Dean says, thoughts on the depths of the football nets in Mexico 86. They were just the great. They're my favourite goal nets of all goal nets. I don't know if anyone else has a strong opinion on this.
I do. Good. I do, actually. Okay, so I was watching, Ryan's going to hate me for saying this, but I was watching the Ajax Bayern game.
Oh, if he talks about this one more time.
Yeah. You see? Stadio tensions. And Overmars scores the final goal, the fifth goal, and the ball gets stuck in the stanchion. And it's the fifth goal, and it looks so satisfying. And it's just sitting there. And I'm like, yes, that's what I like to see. So that's my favourite.
Actually, can I chime in here? This is one of the... I quite like the dimensions of modern-day football goals and nets. But one of the things that I do miss about having a lot of variation or clubs picking their own, you know, system, if you like, is just... You never hear people saying stanchion anymore. It's just a lovely word that's just been erased from football discourse.
There is a game, and I think it's Wolves v Crystal Palace, and someone will correct me on this, where Darren Pitcher and Chris Armstrong score for Palace, and both goals get stuck in the stanchion in the same way Amazing. That Gordon Strachan did for Leeds once. And it's nothing, there is almost, hang on, okay, here's a question. Is staying in the stanchion, and I'll go to you, Ryan, since you have an obsession with stanchions.
That sounds very strange now, doesn't it?
The most the word stanchion has been said in a short period of time on any podcast. Is it better for a goal to get stuck in the stanchion or to go in off the bar, bounce down, and then hit the top of the net?
Ooh.
Oh, Max.
Ooh, that's cruel.
Why did you come to me first? That's really mean.
You're
that's
a like a gauge correspondent.
Well, I have a theory that any goal that goes in off the crossbar, it makes it at least 50% better. So, this is really tough. I can already feel Football Weekly Twitter coming after me, but I'm going to go barring in.
Barry?
Oh, that's the safe choice.
a stanchion for me, definitely. But mainly because I just like seeing stanchion.
Oh, one of us is getting cancelled, Barry.
Do you reckon there is a goal somewhere that went in off the bar, bounced down, and then bounced into the stanchion? That's what we want.
You'd hope so.
Someone will find it.
I like those goals when the ball rolls in the net and out, and the keeper has to see it coming back out as he's lying there. I really enjoy that.
Sort of like
for
classic
some reason.
The Dell, those really tight goal nets. I mean, it happened a lot there.
Yeah, when it just rolls back out and the keeper's just got to see it and taste it. Oh,
that
there
is,
it is
nice when you have like certain, this is going off on a bit of a tangent, sorry, but certain grounds, goals have a certain sound. Mm. There was that great Haaland goal in the first leg against PSG.
Oh, yeah.
His second goal. Was it second? It was his second, wasn't it? The one that he hit from the edge of the box. And the sound it made when it came out was amazing.
While we're on this, I absolutely love goals where the ball rolls into the net and everybody knows it's going in, but no one can do anything about it. In my mind, I've got a Dean Saunders finish that took about half an hour. I can't remember where it's from, but just sort of the agony or the ecstasy of the fans behind. No one can stop it. It's definitely going in, but it is taking an age. we should talk about the kits, Barry, because the Argentina kit story is fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a remarkable story and one that's covered intensely in an edition of The Blizzard, which I think it was by a guy called Dan Andrews. Wilson sent it to us. But Argentina were wearing their change kit, their second kit, the light blue one, and they'd had to wear it in the previous game against Uruguay. And Bilardo decided that all the sweat was being perspired by the players was being kept in the shirt, so he weighed them after the Uruguay game and went, these are way too heavy for the heat we're playing in, we need new shirts. So to cut a very long story short, they ended up going to either a local sports shop or B, a local sports shop actually owned by Argentina's reserve goalkeeper who played his club football in Mexico. And no one's quite sure which. It's been sort of distorted in the telling. And they got these 40 light blue shirts, but then they had the problem, which were, you know, suited Bilardo's needs. But they then had the problem of not having the Argentinian crest on them and not having numbers on them. So, again, it's sort of been distorted in the telling. Some people have it that they just cut the crests off the old jerseys and sewed them on to the new ones. Others say that they got a local computer expert. And remember, 86, computers would have been pretty basic to design one on his Commodore 64. And he sketched one out and printed them off, and they were what were sewn on. But the numbers are perhaps the most interesting because they were sequined, silver sequined American football numbers, and they were sewed onto the shirts by women from a local employees of a local football club. And when the players were presented with these shirts, half of them thought, we're not wearing these. These are disgusting. They're hideous. But Maradona decided he liked them. So if it was okay with him, then it was okay with everyone else. So they wore them. And they were slightly worried they wouldn't get away with the silver numbers because you're supposed to have a white number on your shirt if you're, you know, wearing a on a dark background. But they did. And obviously Maradona's number 10 shirt from that game ended up becoming incredibly iconic. And it's owned by Steve Hodge, who swapped it with him under the sort of in the tunnel after the game. And apparently Maradona like discarded Hodge's shirt as soon as he got back to the dressing room. But Hodge has kept Maradona's shirt. It's in the National Football Museum in Manchester, I believe, and is worth at least 250 grand, if not more.
That's an amazing story. Hodge's autobiography called The Man with Maradona's Shirt. I was going to ask, is there an Argentina podcast somewhere discussing where Steve Hodge's shirt is right now?
Well, funnily enough, Maradona ended up with Gary Lineker's shirt because I think one of the Argentinian subs swapped with Lineker, but Maradona pulled rank on him because he collected number 10 shirts. So he has Lineker's shirt.
Fascinating. We had a lot of questions along these lines. The Pod Addict. Does England going toe-to-toe with a team as strong as Argentina earlier give them great hope ahead of the Euros in 1988? No. And Elliot says, a suggestion for the next group watch, Holland v Portugal, the Battle of Nuremberg. I think we'll decide before Thursday what next weekend's game will be. We might do a Twitter poll, but we'll find out. Moussa, Ryan, I don't know if you have any ideas of a great game that you'd think might be good for us to watch back.
I would ideally like a game that's good.
I would recommend one of the four Clásicos from 2011. Four in 18 days or whatever it was.
Oh, okay.
I'd quite like to go back a bit further.
Moussa?
I would actually, to be honest, I would like to go to the European Cup. I know sorry, Ryan. I do mention the European Cup stuff a lot. I mention the sort of... I would love to go back to that kind of Ajax era, the Red Star Belgrade era, or the AC Milan, to be honest.
That's a good show.
So there was some real gold back then, and I think people would really be pleasantly surprised by just how good the stuff was back then.
Well, look, we'll work it out in the week, and we'll let everybody know what game we're going to watch. And that'll do for part two. Part three features podcasting through a crisis, positivity corner, and plenty of your questions, and chapter one of Detective Wilson. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Right, podcasting through a crisis, lads. You guys started recording last week from your own homes, not in the same room together. Just asking for a bit of guidance, really, for me and Barry. What have you found have been the main differences?
It's been interesting, actually. I think it's been going more smoothly than I would have expected it to, because so we do it on a Google Hangout so we can actually see each other as well, which I think was the major concern for me, because I produce and edit as well as co-host it. So the one thing I was really worried about was losing the kind of flow that we have on the podcast when we're sat in the same room. But actually, I think apart from the odd mishap, it's been really good having the visual element there, and I think actually quite important. And because there's only two of us, we can do it fairly easily. I don't know what you think, Moussa.
No, absolutely. It's been really great. I was just concerned about losing the flow of conversation. But like you say, the visual side helps that. And I think, you know, because Ryan has to edit my voice all the time, I think it's quite good for me not to be around him too much either. So that's good too. I think the social distancing's worked very well for us, actually. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's fine. I miss you, man. I miss you. It's like I see you all the time, but I miss you, you know?
Oh. I was just thinking, aside from my wife, the last person I hugged or the last person's hand I shook is a weird thing to think, isn't it? You know, who's the next hand that I will shake?
Oh, my God, that's a great point.
Wow, that sounds like a...
How often do you shake hands with your wife?
I don't shake my wife's hands.
Good morning. Good morning, dear.
Make a business decision. That's a bit like... That's a bit like Alan Sugar. Didn't he famously sign a birthday card for his wife, Alan Sugar, because he just got it and signed it?
So your wife announces, oh, I'm going to bed, Max, and gives you a little look, and you just shake hands with her and say, yeah, I'll be up in a minute.
Maybe just both fans of the Aubameyang Lacazette celebration.
Exactly. Now, you guys have been self-isolating for longer than people in the UK. What have you learned about yourself, Moussa?
I can cook actually quite good food, which is good. I'm quite good at procrastinating, putting off tasks. I'm very good at that, but I knew that 20 years ago, so that's not news to anyone, or indeed any of my exes who might stumble across this podcast. I'm pleasantly surprised by how well I'm holding up. I mean, Ryan and I have been doing it longer than most people in Germany, actually, because we clocked onto this quite early, I think, with the reports coming from Italy. And also I think it was fairly easy for us, given our setup, to have the flexibility to work from home. So we kind of took advantage of that. And it's been really nice, to be honest, in a weird way, because as difficult as it's been on an individual level, there's definitely a sense that you're contributing to something important. Like I have friends who a week and a half ago were like out and about, like not doing anything. And like one of them's gone back to Bavaria to be with her family, like they're in quarantine. And if you spoke to her a week and a half ago, she would have laughed this whole thing off. And now she's taking it really seriously. And I do think that's partly because of conversations people like me had with her going, look, you've got to take this thing seriously. Cause it's not just It's not scaremongering. It's not scaremongering. It's the real thing. So although it's been personally awkward and difficult at times, I'm proud to have been doing it at this point, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an important point about people realizing how serious this is. And I don't think there's a shame in having that realization moment, right? You know, it has to happen to all of us at some point.
Right.
And hopefully that is happening. I was doing the radio with Darren Bent this morning and he's still going to his barber. And by the end of the show, he said, right, I'm not going to go to my barber. I'm going to let my hair grow out. And that is important because that's, you can see how that's going to transfer the virus. Given, you know, there is no football to review for you guys, and this is where Barry and I get a pen and paper. What are you looking to do with your podcast?
Well, for Stadio, I think we kind of tend to go off in strange directions occasionally anyway. So we've basically just been, well, first of all, we're really lucky that we get such amazing questions on the podcast as well that can often carry the show on their own. And I think it's really, I don't like doing, you know, kind of like public based content, if that makes sense, that kind of term where you let people dictate what they want to hear. But I think the questions are really good because sometimes they throw up themes that we may not have considered. And it sounds a little bit like cheating, but I think that we're quite lucky that there is a nice back and forth between us and the listeners who regularly contribute questions. So we had some ideas anyway, and we've also picked up a few from various questions, but we did one last week which was a what ifs podcast. So basically looking at certain moments through football history, for example the Aguero goal against QPR. And yeah, the obvious what if Aguero doesn't score that is that Manchester City don't win the league and Manchester United do. But actually going further down the line, and we came to the conclusion that probably the landscape of European football could look vastly different throughout the whole of that decade. You know, even down to the point where Robin van Persie doesn't leave Arsenal. How does that leave Arsenal looking, and all of this kind of stuff? And the same, for example, if Johan Cruyff was born in England, and it's not just that he may have been a different kind of player, it's that actually you maybe don't get Barcelona's European Cup, and you maybe don't get the transformation to La Masia. So it's, those are really fun because if people disagree, then people are going to disagree in a different way than if you say, you know, something bad about a certain player, because it's all conceptual and theoretical. But also they're just kind of fun. And I think they're conversations that people usually have among friends as well. So it feels like hopefully an extension of that for people. And without sounding too self-important or self-righteous, I think that because everything is so chaotic at the moment, even though we're a really, really small podcast, obviously compared to like you guys and a number of others, I think if we can, we as soon as we decided to kind of lock down, we actually decided that we would do two a week no matter what for the foreseeable, because I think that if we can contribute in some way to some level of regularity with people who listen to us, then I think if we can do it, which we can, which is why we've done it, then we should do it.
Yeah, I think we feel the same, actually. He would be called John Cruyff, wouldn't he, if he was born in England, and the Cruyff Turn would be...
the Cruyff Turn's actually a pub in Basingstoke.
and Moussa, if there was one thing you were looking forward to covering when this is all over, one sporting fixture or just one footballing thing you're looking forward to?
What if it gets resumed
in a way that we remember it?
Oh my god, the Champions League is the most exciting. I mean, I said I'm not missing football that much, but I can't wait for this Champions League to come to conclusion, because I think that the draw was absolutely perfect. I think every team matched up against the worst possible opponent for them, and I think that so much great football is going to come, and I think the catharsis actually of having football back will drive people to new level. I think you're going to see people come back like really hungry, fit, well rested, because a lot of these players haven't had a break for like a couple of years. This will be the longest holiday a lot of footballers have had for ages, if that makes sense.
I mean, as if you say a holiday is dancing on your marble staircase,
than
doing kick-ups with a toilet roll.
Yeah, exactly. To Positivity Corner. Manchester United and Manchester City have donated £100,000 to Manchester food banks. Each club will donate £50,000 to the Trussell Trust, a network of over 1,200 food bank centres, including 19 in the greater Manchester area. Barry, do you... Like, all money is good money. Do you feel £100,000? So I don't want to be critical of them giving only £100,000. But
it's not much, is it? It would be the equivalent of me giving a quid to a food bank, less 10p. Manchester City are owned by the richest family in the world. And Manchester United are one of the richest, if not the richest, clubs in the world, but from a commercial point of view.
But better they do it than don't do it.
It's better than nothing, but, you know, making a big fanfare, oh, look what we've done, over £100,000.
Nah.
Yeah, in Germany, they're, Leon Goretzka and Joshua Kimmich from Bayern Munich have actually set up their own fund called We Kick Corona. And Robert Lewandowski and his wife, Anna, have just joined it as well. And they've already raised €2.5 million, which is to, they're inviting charities and social institutions to apply for funds to like be donated out of that fund. And I imagine they only started this a few days ago, I think. And I can imagine a number of Bundesliga players stepping in. And if they've already raised 2.5 million with just three people signing up, you'd hope that it would kind of push on a lot. And also in Germany, it'd be worth mentioning the work a lot of ultras groups are doing for local communities in times like this. Felix Tamsa on Twitter is a really good follow for stuff like that, and he's been writing a thread, a rolling thread of examples of ultras groups in Germany doing really good stuff at this time.
And Borussia Mönchengladbach's players have all agreed to take a pay cut, I think.
Yeah, they have. Yeah,
it's interesting you say that. Simon Jordan was on the radio yesterday saying, if every Premier League player, or every player actually, not just Premier League, who's paid more than £30,000 a week took a 20% pay cut. I think that's the maths that he did. And the PFA donated their £30 million that they get paid from the broadcasters that he says they don't need. You could build up a inverted commas, war chest of about £300 million, which feasibly would be enough to keep all the lower league clubs in business, the ones that are struggling. And therefore the football family, if that's what you want to call it, don't have to worry about getting money from the government, etc. On paper, it sounds like a nice idea, but 20% is a lot.
Be a bit sceptical on that front? I'm always interested how it's players who are supposed to be the first line of remedy in the sport. So not only do they entertain us primarily, their job is also to educate us on racism and like be our philanthropists. And I'm like, well, wages are still a certain percentage of a club's turnover, right? So if you're going to go into anyone's pocket first, it should be the club and then the players. I've got nothing against players taking pay cuts if it's part of a structure of overall pay cuts, but I'm not seeing much responsibility at the corporate level. And I don't have an issue with clubs giving sums to charity. I think that's a really good start. The 100,000, the combined amount, actually, I think it's a good start. But if you look at the budget, right, the government budget for coronavirus, they started out with 30 billion and they increased it 11-fold because they realized that wasn't enough. So I hope that clubs will say, okay, right, we started with this amount, but actually, look what else is being done. We could have been less tentative. Let's go further. So I think it's a good start, but I also think there's a structural issue about this way that the perception of like, oh, there's a problem in football, there's a money is an issue, we go to the players first. I don't actually think that players should be leading the conversation as admirable as it is when they do.
I agree with that because so many players have their own foundations or, charitable setups that they have away from the clubs anyway. And they do a huge amount of work that often isn't covered or recognised. And I mean, in this situation, I kind of agree with the principle to what Simon Jordan was saying, but I think this is yet another example where, like Musa said, you're leaving it up to someone can throw out a suggestion like that and it's kind of on the players to either accept it or not, whereas this should come from the FA, if I'm being honest. The FA should draw up an initiative to take it to clubs and then take it to players and say, this is the plan and this is why we're doing it, because they're essentially the head of, they're in charge of football in England. So if it is going to come from someone, a nice detailed rollout plan from the FA as to what that entails and why they're doing it, I think a lot of people would sign up. But I mean, I personally won't hold my breath on the FA delivering something that kind of well thought out.
I think like a lot of Simon Jordan's suggestions, this one is good in theory, but hugely impractical. From a legal point of view, players get what they're contractually, you know, designated in wages. You can't just compel them to hand over 20%. Some players might not be able to afford it. That might sound ludicrous for people who are on 30 grand a week. But, you know, if you're on 30 grand a week, take away tax, take away agents, take away bills, mortgages, who knows how many dependents they might have. It all adds up. A lot of recently retired Premier League footballers are skint. They're bankrupt because they made bad investments, they got ripped off or whatever. I was thinking about this from a personal point of view. I'm a single man with no dependents. I do okay. I'm not far from wealthy. Could I survive if I was compelled to take a 20% pay cut? Yeah, easily. But plenty of my colleagues who I presume are on similar-ish money wouldn't be able to, because they have children to support, they have parents to support, they have medical expenses to pay. I'm lucky enough not to have any of that. So you just can't impose a blanket 20% deduction. You can't be done. But players should be welcome to volunteer it if someone sets up an initiative. Many of them might. Although after Juan Mata set up his scheme, what's that called?
Common Goal.
It's 1%, which you signed up for. That was for 1%.
Yeah.
I think you and possibly two other people signed up, Max, and that's pretty much it, which kind of shows how willing they are.
It does have some footballers, but I was going to bring that up. It hasn't changed the landscape. You know, I wondered if every footballer would do it. And you're right, that's 1%, which is significantly different. You know, that's, I'm trying to work it out, that's half a week's wages, isn't it? I guess 1%. Does that work like that? If there's 50 weeks in a year, 52 weeks, 1% is 1%, says producer. Thank you so much.
Wow.
He really went around the houses on that one. You could actually
Someone needs to self-isolate.
You could see that plane coming into land, couldn't you? Yes, oh my God.
But yeah, so you're right. But I suppose to be fair to Simon Jordan, Henry Winter wrote a piece saying money needs to filter down, but didn't really offer a plan at all.
And no, it is a plan, but it's not very well thought out, I suspect.
Sure.
I think like Barry said, I think it's going to be really tricky from a legal standpoint to implement it as a must do. But like I was saying before, if the FA came up with a really, really well thought out initiative as to why they were doing it and took it to clubs and made it opt in and optional, then I could see that happening. I mean, you can't, like Barry said, you can't dictate to clubs and players that they have to do this, but I think that players get a really bad rep for being, you know, greedy or whatever, because people just see the wages that they're on. But so many of them do pretty much all of them I know. I mean, every top level footballer pretty much does amazing charitable work, and I think that you would be surprised how many people would probably sign up to something like that. And actually, with Common Goal, it's really, really, really grown over the last few years. You know, even like Jurgen Klopp signed up and made a big announcement when he got his, was it Coach of the Year award last year? And it seems to be a lot more mainstream than it was a few years ago. But yeah, I think players would probably sign up to something like that.
It's weird that there was more traction when Klopp made his announcement than when I did. I don't know why.
Hey, you just got to do what you can, Max.
Now, Liverpool Chief Executive Peter Moore has announced Anfield stewards are volunteering to help with crowd control and assisting the elderly at supermarkets amid the panic buying and aggressive behaviour. He put a call out on Twitter for local supermarkets to get in touch with him. Some questions. Kevin says, what is the best household item to play a game of football with in the living room? That's a very good question. If you don't use a toilet roll, I have seen on that toilet roll thing people getting upset with celebrities and footballers for doing keepy-ups with toilet rolls. But as far as I can tell, you can still...
Why are they getting upset?
Because people don't have enough toilet rolls.
These are just those idiots that are desperate to be offended about anything. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, I can't imagine they
use the toilet roll.
I can't imagine they just throw it out after they've done keep-ups with it. I think they probably put it back in the bathroom.
Have you not seen the brilliant video? They do a video like an amateur football team, a Sunday league team, and they all pass the ball around to each other, the toilet roll, and the final one is their mate on the loo catching it. And then it fades as he's about to use it. It's genius. It's genius.
Speaking of people on the loo, have you seen the Google Hangout work meeting or the Zoom work meeting where there's like 12 people having a work meeting and is it poor Jennifer or something?
Jennifer.
It's this Jennifer, she just puts her laptop down and sits down and pulls her kecks down and sits on the toilet and then realises what's happened and then disappears from the conversation while everyone's in hysterics. David said, your favourite 90s shirt sponsor, please. I mean, I could do a whole pod on shirt sponsors, but okay, Musa.
Mediolanum, AC Milan.
Describe it for those.
Oh my God, it's that beautiful. So it's Mediolanum. I think it's like Italian banking consortium, and it's like the really long word. So it's beautiful white font, and it goes right across the red and white Milan shirt.
Mm. Oh yeah,
and they change it to Motta a couple of years later, and that's when they start getting bad. That's my theory.
Nice.
Yeah, Mediolanum. That's beautiful.
It's a really strong one. Can you improve on that, Ryan?
Yeah, but definitely. Aston Villa's period where they had Müller as a sponsor purely because when was the last time you saw a yogurt sponsoring a football team?
No, that's a very good shout. I must admit, my real memory is from sort of a bit earlier, sort of 86, 87. I did like Wang for Oxford United just because I like the word Wang. I've not a clue what Wang is or what Wang does or what it did, but I'm all for the Wang. Barry?
I'm not sure if it's quite in the 90s. I reckon it probably is. When Super Furry Animals, the Welsh band, one of my favourites, sponsored Cardiff City shirts when they had their logo on it.
That's a great one, isn't it?
And Skint Records used to sponsor Brighton as well, didn't they? Fatboy Slim's label.
Yeah, that's true. They're all a bit hipster for me. I like old school electrical company.
JVC and Arsenal, the perfect match.
Yeah, yeah. I did like NEC. NEC on that Everton shirt in the mid-80s was really nice, I think. Just that whole shirt was a beautiful thing.
I quite enjoyed Manchester United when they had Sharp and then 1 year all of a sudden it had ViewCam underneath it. I was like, ooh.
That looked great, like yeah.
A little variation on the classic.
Lads, you didn't have girlfriends when you were younger, did you? Or significant others of any kind?
Girlfriends? You say, did we have girlfriends? What are those, Barry? Sorry.
Well, you know, I was only born in 84, so you know, in the 90s, it's a bit too young for girlfriends. My first true love was shirt sponsors.
Barry was a very early developer.
God, I wasn't.
Producer Jonathan's put Goldie Looking Chains sponsoring Newport County with the Goldie Looking the chain sort of medallion round the neck is nice. Here's a question from Hot Takes. How long is it acceptable to go without a shower if you're self-isolating alone? Let's start with you, Ryan.
As long as you want.
Musa?
A day. A day, really, because it just starts creeping in on you. Everything starts creeping in on you. Got to have one a day. Got to have one a day.
It festers, I think. Barry?
Yeah, one a day.
One a day. Okay. Well, listen, we're going to finish on this, which is marvellous. Over the weekend, producer Jonathan received a DM from a man called Jamie Biddle. And he said, I was just wondering whether you would be taking any submissions for Detective Wilson for next Monday's pod. I'm a writer and director living in London, suddenly find myself with a lot of time on my hand. I'm a huge fan of police procedurals, the pod and its guests, and I'd love to have a crack at chapter one for you guys to peruse. All the best from lockdown, Biddle. So, I have written a chapter and it is terrible. This all stemmed because Richard Osman signed a seven-figure deal for a detective novel. I thought, I better give this a try. This seems like a good idea. And I sat in my garden last July and wrote chapter one, and we'll read it out at some point. And it is, as Barry will
I can attest, it is dreadful, truly dreadful. And I actually thought it was deliberately dreadful. Then I realised that he was actually trying really hard.
I wasn't trying that hard. I only spent 45 minutes. So anyway, here is chapter one of Detective Wilson, written by Jamie Biddle. Chapter one. Oh, I do like to be beside the seaside. He turned the corner onto Roots Hall Drive and immediately saw the flashing lights of his ex-brothers in arms. "I'm too old for this shit," he muttered to himself. Wilson rolled down the window to greet the officer walking over to him and got a lungful of the North Sea air. Nature's espresso coursed through his veins and sharpened his senses. Good. Like Cochrane Sunderland of the 30s, he'd need every single one of them working to their max. He'd gotten the call from the bear at about 3 a.m. "You awake?" Immediately, Wilson had been caught off guard. He was used to DCI Glendenning calling him at all hours of the night, usually with liquor on his breath and sorrow in his heart. This time was different. He sounded sober. He sounded cold. "Bloody hell, Baz, I was asleep," he responded. "What's up?" "Get your ass down Roots Hall. I've got a job for you," the bear growled. He couldn't stop himself from being a little bit intrigued. What was going on? Why him? But no, he'd got himself out of the game for a reason. To spend his days poring over the statistics of pre-war European football and offering the odd acerbic comment on the modern game. "I'm retired, Baz. Get someone else," he said, managing to abate his lust for the case. "Listen here, you feckin' idiot. You're retired when I say you're feckin' retired. Now you can get to your posies and your statistics and your bloody Hungarians on your own time, but right now you're getting your feckin' ass to Roots Hall. Do you understand?" And that was that. He called it the super soaker. The bear always knew how to convince him. Whether it be to take out one last case or stay out for 19 pints, he had a way about him. He rolled down his window to greet the officer on guard. Unfortunately, it was an old friend. "Fuck are you doing here, Wilson?" DC Mark Langdon spat. HP sauce from his breakfast bacon roll still framing the corners of his mouth. "I was invited, Mark. What are you doing here? Shouldn't you be inside, or have top brass finally come to their senses?" He could see the rage fill Langdon's eyes. "Listen here, you over the hill. Oi!" shouted a voice from behind. "He's with me." DC Lloyd Hughes marched over to the car. "You can't be serious," muttered Langdon. Flo shot him a look that promised a castration and dropped his shoulder and marched back to his post in one fluid movement. Sad. Once upon a time, he might have put that aggression of his towards something else, terrorising an ageing back line, perhaps. But no, he chose corruption and hate. There are many cautionary tales with names like Mark Langdon. "Sorry, John, I know it's late," Flo said. "Let's just get this over with," he replied. "Tell me why I'm here." Flo led the way through the stadium and onto the pitch, barking orders at every officer that she left in her wake. Wilson was impressed. Last time people referred to him as detective, she'd been working traffic, gone up through the ranks like lightning, the force's very own Blackburn Rovers. He hoped that she wouldn't share a similar future. They stepped out onto the pitch, and what immediately caught his eye was not the body lying prone in the centre circle, but the way the rest of the officers were all standing on the touchline, as though worried about interfering with play. Odd. He shook it off and allowed himself just a shot of nostalgia by drinking in the stands, the dugouts, the goal frames. This is what he'd left the force for. But now fate had brought the two sides of his life together like a venomous and potent cocktail, and it didn't taste good.
Oh my God.
The last time he was here had been May, Sunderland away. The terraces had been heaving on a balmy Saturday afternoon. Maguire had brought them back into it with a pen, but a late winner had done for him in the end. He allowed himself a quick smile, but then quickly steeled himself, and he needed to be sharp. "Do we know the victim's identity?" he asked. "Unfortunately, yes." She paused. "Both of us," she said flatly. He was starting to understand why it had been him that got the call. He was closer now and saw the victim wasn't wearing any socks. "Not the kid," he said under his breath. Sam Diss, the Mundy Isle kid, a periphery character, lay prone in the centre circle. His eyes were wide, and under the floodlights, his blood gave the pitch a feeling of Christmas. Poor lad would never see another. Wilson had never really liked Sam. Maybe it was his constant chatter, his references to pingers on his FIFA video game, or just his perpetual good mood. He'd suspected, however, that the kid had always seemed to look up to him, seeking the old hand's approval, but he would never give it. How he regretted that now. Flo interrupted his thoughts. "Seems like someone lured him here, John. Someone who wanted him dead." "Who?" Wilson inquired. But at that moment, something felt strange. A minute ago, the other officers were playing linesman, and now they were assuming formation for kickoff. "Do you know why we've asked you to come here?" Flo asked. Wilson's head was starting to spin. What on earth was going on? Just like Kevin Phillips, however, he kept his composure. "Because I'm the best, Flo. That's why," he replied, his voice steady. "True, but there's something else." Her eyes dropped to Sam's corpse on the floor. Wilson furrowed his brow
and also looked at the kid one more time. That was when he saw it, something he hadn't noticed before, a small scrap of paper covered in Sam's blood next to his hand. Spidery lettering. Meet me at Roots Hall, 3 a.m. Got a scoop. J.W. The smell of a greasy breakfast butty invaded Wilson's nostrils. To think, I didn't want to get out of bed this morning. He swiveled round to meet Langdon's triumphant gaze. Detective Wilson, I'm arresting you on suspicion of the murder of Sam Diss, said Flo, as flat as the football played on this pitch. Well, detective, looks like you've caught me in an offside trap. Right. Now it says, what will happen to Detective Wilson next? You decide. Choose route A for Enter the Bear. Choose route B for The Great Escape. Your first reaction, Barry, to chapter one?
It was very long.
It's also brilliant, Barry.
No, hats off. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's tremendous, isn't it? Moose or Ryan, are you hoping to get roles in this?
I thought the dialogue was really good, actually.
It was very well written.
The dialogue, yeah, that to me is the strongest part. Like, I was like, and it's the hardest part to nail. Yeah, dialogue was strong.
As long as you don't kill me off, Max, that's fine.
Well, it's not up to me.
I'm only just getting going. Let me live.
Black guy in a thriller. I'm surprised I'm not dead yet. So yeah, I'm just happy to still be involved.
Get out, Musa. Get out.
Exactly. Get out.
So listen, thank you so much to Jamie Biddle. We love that. We'll put out a Twitter poll. We don't know how quickly it takes you to write each chapter, but we will find out. And that'll do for today's Guardian Football Weekly. Thank you so much for being down the line, Musa and Ryan. We really appreciate it. And, you know, come back again.
Thank you so much. Absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having us, guys.
And Barry, thank you.
Thank you.
Thursday, we'll be broadcasting from our own homes. So if I ever see you again, I'll be excited to see what 3 months of self-isolation does to you.
I reckon I'll be all right. My alcohol intake has already plummeted. I've an exercise plan in place. I'm going to learn several new languages, learn how to pick locks, and I'll just come out like Leonardo da Vinci. A very slim, toned Leonardo da Vinci.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.